Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. My guest for this week's episode is Stephen Kirby, and he is the founder of Wounded Healer Outreach, The Unchurch, and the Entheogenic Explorers Podcast. I was actually featured on his podcast a few weeks ago, and we did do an interview with Stephen for this podcast prior to that, but because of delays and having interviews stacked up in the old bank ready to come out, that we're just releasing this right now. We'll get to Stephen in just a couple of moments, but first, of course, I do have a few quick announcements to make before we get into this week's interview. I do want to thank Brooke for making her regular monthly contribution via PayPal in support of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As I always remind you guys out there in listener land, this is a listener-supported podcast. It is made available for free to all of you out there in listener land. And if you would like to support this podcast, it is always greatly welcomed and appreciated. If you'd like to make a contribution via PayPal, you can stop by my personal webpage at martinball.net. Use the PayPal link at the top right of the page. Or if you would like to join as a patron over at my Patreon page, there is also a link for my Patreon page there at the top right of my personal webpage. Or you can go directly to patreon.com/martinwball and sign up at the level that is comfortable for you, anywhere from $1 a month up to $100 a month. And of course, at the $100 a month level, that gets you a 1 hour monthly video check-in or consultation. And just to clarify about my consultations, I do work with people who are looking for help integrating and reflecting upon their entheogenic experience that they have had, and they're looking for someone to help sort through what kind of energetic process they may be in and what they can do about it. And I'm always happy to help folks like that, but I also do just offer, conversation, reflection, little guidance about a whole variety of issues. And I also do work with a number of people who facilitate medicine experiences, not just 5-MeO-DMT, but a whole wide range of psychedelic medicines, and work as kind of a sounding board. People will sometimes come to me with some challenging cases that they've had and want to help get some insight into what's going on or what they might be able to do about it. And I'm always happy to help you at whatever level or wherever you're at within the process, either as a client or as a facilitator or someone looking to get into medicine experiences. I'm always happy to help you. And we have 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations available. My website for that is www.nondualentheogenicintegration.com. You can always check it out over there. Let's see. What else have we got going on? I did want to mention, I've mentioned this before, but now it is official. I do have my plane ticket, and the Church of Psilocybin is flying me out to Austin, Texas for their Entheogenesis event. It was originally going to be a 2 to 3 day event, but they've narrowed it down to 1 day. It's going to be Saturday, April 15th, starting at 10 a.m. in the morning and going to 11 p.m. at night. That's going to be in Austin, Texas. You can go to psilomethoxin.com. That's psilomethoxin.com for more information and for tickets. And I'm really looking forward to that. They've got me lined up to give a couple different talks. One is about music and its role in entheogenic experience. Always one of my favorite topics, and one that I don't think I've ever really gotten an opportunity to speak about publicly before. Of course, as a musician, I love music and I love psychedelic experience and I love combining them together. And it's going to be a pleasure to be able to speak about that and also to be available for just a general Q&A session to get into whatever the audience wants to get into, which I'm always happy to do. So thank you very much, Church of Psilocybin, for buying that ticket and arranging to have me come on out and join the fun. It's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to that. So let's see, other announcements. Well, just to update you all that have not made any progress on my audiobook for my novel, The Fate of Mirani. Just thought I'd give you an update. It's been busy with a little bit more travel and quite a few consultations and interviews. So haven't had any free time in my schedule to work on the audiobook, but hopefully this next week I'm going to get back into that because I don't have a whole lot on my schedule. But still working in that. Of course, all of my audiobooks are available at Audible, Amazon, the iBookstore, all those regular places you can find books. Sometimes people ask me where they can find them, and it's those places. And hope to make some more progress on the Fate of Mirani coming up really soon, and I'll update you here as things develop, you know, if you're interested. So let's talk a little bit about Stephen Kirby. He actually first came to me as a consultation client, and then he's moved into all these other areas and kind of developing his own presence within the psychedelic community. And it was a great pleasure to have him here on the podcast. Just to repeat again, he is the founder of the UnChurch, also Wounded Healer Outreach, and the Entheogenic Explorers podcast. You can find out more about Stephen and his work online at woundedhealeroutreach, all one word, .com, and also theunchurch.com, also just one word. Well, let's go ahead and get into our interview. I do have to apologize that my audio level was set just perfectly at the very beginning of our interview as we were doing a quick check-in, and then I don't know if a connection got loose or something, but my audio level dropped way down throughout the duration of the interview that I was not aware of until going back and listening to it to prep it for the podcast today. So I've had to kind of tweak my end of the conversation. That you're going to hear some background humming and hiss and stuff like that because something happened, and I didn't find out about it till it was all done. But anyway, you'll still be able to hear. It's just not the pristine audio that I would have preferred going out on the podcast today, but it is what it is. And of course, at the end of the interview, I'll put in some of my own music for you to enjoy. I don't know what I'm going to choose right now, so I'm not going to name it. But of course, you can find my music at martinball.bandcamp.com and YouTube Music, Apple Music, Spotify, all of those places anyway. So here's the conversation with Stephen Kirby. Hope you enjoy. We're going to be talking about Wounded Healer Outreach. We're going to be talking about the UnChurch. We're going to be talking about Bufo and 5-MeO DMT. We're going to be talking about ayahuasca and really anything else that you want to bring into the mix today. So we have a wide variety of options to choose from. But first of all, Kirby, just want to say welcome to the podcast. And nice to have you here.
I appreciate it. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and let's start at the standard place where I like to start with most people who are new to the audience. And I think you definitely fit in that category. You're not a big public person, though you're getting a little bit more public. So let's just start with an introduction to you, to Stephen Kirby. Who are you? Where do you come from? What's your story, man? What's your deal?
What's my story? It's a good question, actually. My name's Stephen Kirby, but I go by Kirby for multiple reasons. But so Kirby is how most folks know me. I'm a 50-year-old retired financial professional in the last decade has shifted into some of this work with entheogens. Since then, I've founded the UnChurch, which is a DMT church. My understanding is I think we're the first legal DMT church, not just ayahuasca church, but DMT, so we could serve multiple sacraments. So we serve here out of the Midwest. I also, as you mentioned, run Wounded Healers Outreach, which is where I do a lot of the spiritual life coaching, integration, psychedelic preparation, trauma work, et cetera. So I do a lot of work over on that side of it. But besides that, yeah, I'm just a retired old guy that loves talking about these topics and talking about these medicines, sacraments, whatever you feel comfortable calling them, and how they make an impact in people's lives.
Cool. So, yeah, we're both 50. You're 50, I'm 50. When did you turn 50?
October this last year, so.
Did you start getting mail from the AARP?
I did. They sucked me in with the high-quality offer of a trunk cooler, a $10 value sign up. So I'm like, my wife's like, I could use a trunk cooler. I'm like, well, then I'm an AARP member. Simple as that. Your marketing worked. So I have yet to get my discount on anything yet, but I'll find my spots.
Yeah. I was a little surprised when I got that same mailing. It's like, oh wow. They already know, huh? Okay. I didn't get my trunk cooler though, but it's a cool idea. You know, I just might sign up for that.
My wife would probably say it's worth it. But it's interesting that 50 now is old. It made me feel old, but.
Yeah.
There's that.
Hold on. Moxie's got to go bark at the birds or the deer or something. I'll be right back. Hold on.
Fair enough.
you know, dog, she can't help being a dog. Got to do the dog thing.
No, I've got my dog sitting right next to me, and I got my little kitten on my lap, so I'm surrounded by it, so I get it.
Nice, all animaled up. So let's talk about the transition from working in finance to working in plant medicines. And here, you know, it's up to you what you want to share of your personal life and personal development, but I'm always interested in the question of, well, what brought you into plant medicine in the first place? What piqued your interest? Why did you turn to it? And how did that develop for you?
Yeah, I think many folks, maybe I shouldn't say that, for me anyway, very specifically for me, I had tried talk therapy. I'd gone through lots of different avenues to try to just feel happy. To be honest, I mean, I was getting through life. I was what they would call successful on lots of different measurements. But to me, I was just not a happy person. And I guess my theory on that is maybe we're at a unique time in history where we're getting older, we're living longer, because I've got a 23-year-old son, and I don't remember raising him as being that difficult because I was just in this pure survival mode, make money, make a living, pay bills. And I think at some stage in our life, we transition into having a little bit of spare time, and then we start thinking about our existence and what do we want to do. And it hit me pretty square in the face that that's not what I want to do. I want to enjoy my existence on this planet. So I tried every modality. The thought of trying another prescription, going that route to me was a dead end. And I saw a documentary on ayahuasca, the typical line of, you know, 20 years worth of therapy in a weekend being a driver to me. I'm like, well, that seems efficient. Let's do that. So then it was just trying to find a group that did it. I got very lucky. I found somebody local that got me down to Florida, and I had my first ayahuasca ceremony. You know, a lot of folks like at that stage for you to share this amazing transformational story, but that just, it wasn't it for me. It was a change. But I felt something was missing. I felt that was the step in the right direction. So I felt that I was at least on some sort of path. So that brought some level of relief. But as I continued to do ayahuasca, I did it for about 2 years. So I'd do a ceremony a month. And again, I would feel this level of relief, but I also felt something was missing. And so I just continued to go back. And the group I was with is a phenomenal group, but integration wasn't emphasized as much as the conversations you and I have had about the importance of it, the need for it. I probably could have done half the AI I did if I was a little bit more focused on integration and taking advantage of what that looks like. But being a hard head, I'm like, let's just go do more medicine, right? So it's not an unstandard trajectory for folks, but it's one now that I do what I do. I try to keep people off of it. There's just more efficient ways of doing it. But then my shaman started going through some personal struggles, and just her and I were friends. We'd start having conversations, and she went off and did Bufo. And I remember the call with her. She said, "You've got to go do this." And I was like, "Oh, okay. That's big coming from you." So I went online, watched a few videos of, you know, the traditional thing that you would see on YouTube, the person having the contortions, the explosive experience, the exorcism, so to speak. And I'm watching this thinking, nah, I don't think I need to do this. And then the follow-up questions were, well, what did it do for you? I don't know. Well, what did you see? Nothing. All my questions were just answered with like things that weren't very good marketing material to me. I don't know if anything, nothing. I'm like, well, this isn't a very good sell. So I just put it in the back of my mind, but she continued to tell me, try to express how it had changed her, but it was very difficult to verbalize it. So I had my experience. I went to a traditional N,N-dimethyltryptamine ceremony down in Florida, sold on the Joe Rogan experience, like a lot of other folks back in the day. Terrence McKenna, I wanted to see the elves and all the UFOs. And I was thinking maybe that would provide some healing, maybe something more intense. So I signed up for that. I went down, and I remember I showed up. There was this beautiful Spanish lady named Mirna, this older woman. And I'm like, I'm ready for the DMT. And she's like, well, we don't have any more of that. All we have is Bufo. Traditional Western guy. I'm like, what do you mean? I got the rental car, the hotel. I've given you said payment. Where said product, right? This is how it works here in the States. I gave you money, you give me the experience. I'm here. What am I doing here? And she just looked me right in the eyes. She's maybe 5 foot tall. I'm 6'7". She looked me up and said, "You need to do BUFO." And I'm like, "I don't know." She's like, "You need to do it. You're here. You're going to do it next. We're clearing the schedule for you." And I'm like, "Okay." And in the background, I hear some guy screaming at the top of his lungs. And I'm thinking, "What are you doing here? What are you doing here?" But long story short, my turn, got in front of the shaman, pretty popular guy from Mexico. We read a prayer. That was a traditional piece. I did the medicine. They had me do two doses back to back, and then essentially just kind of shifted me to the side, said, "We've got some other folks coming. Go recoup over here." And I just remember sitting in the grass, and the first thought that came to my mind was, be careful who you let serve this to you. Honestly, that was the first thought. I was like, this is serious stuff. This is not light work. This is serious stuff. Be careful who you let do this to you, if ever do it again, number one. And number two, what just happened to you? What just happened? You know, I had this feeling of, I knew something massive had happened. I knew that something was shifting, but I didn't know what it was. And after that moment became the exploration of where we are now. I did it a month later. I did it another month later. And then I just started getting into a training protocol with these folks and just going down the rabbit hole of it. But the driver was, what is happening with this sacrament? What is happening with this molecule? And that kind of led to the destruction of the financial advisor. Just happened organically. Again, that career, unfortunately, is driven by fear or greed, right? Fear of not having enough, or fear and greed really are the two emotions that drive that industry. And that just didn't feel like me anymore. So I started transitioning out of that. And ironically, my business originally was a Christian-based financial firm.
Really?
And 5MEO, yes, absolutely destroyed that foundation. And so it was inevitable. As I was meeting with folks, it was time. So I started shifting out of that, sold my practice a few years back, and have been doing this pretty much full time since.
Well, thanks for that quick rundown, Kirby. There's a couple things I just want to highlight within there that I thought was of particular interest. One is how you said that going to ayahuasca, even doing it multiple times over a series of months, that you weren't getting the big transformative event, the big ahas, you know, that wasn't happening for you. And I just think that that's really important to acknowledge and just kind of take note of, because there are so many stories. I mean, it's kind of one of the issues about the psychedelic movement, that it's flooded with deeply transformative accounts that people have, and then also flooded with horrific, difficult, challenging accounts. And what gets lost within that is that there's a lot of ho-hum experiences in between those extremes. And so it can be misleading on both the positive and negative side. And like when it comes to 5-MeO DMT, that I've often told people, you know, don't go actually watching people's experiences on YouTube. Don't go looking at those. Don't go reading trip reports on Arrowhead or things like that, because a lot of times you get the really explosive sort of negative reports. And as you know from watching these videos on YouTube, a lot of them are just showing that's obviously how not to do it. Yet this is being kind of promoted and advertised as, look at this amazing experience. And then, you know, then we also have the other side where we've had social media influencers saying, yeah, I did BUFO this weekend. It was life transforming. Living your best life. You know, bye. Just sort of these flippant, sort of off the cuff remarks about it. You know, so in other words, we don't necessarily get a really balanced approach. And this is where I always like to say with any of these medicines, with like 5-MeO, I always say, look, results vary. Okay. Yes. It's really important to recognize that there's a whole range of experiences. And also, even when it comes to, you know, like how much people are being served, like even that really varies a lot. Some people respond to just a few milligrams. Some people you really need to wallop. So there's no magic numbers. There's no perfect situation. And so I just like that you were able to share that, look, I went to ayahuasca and yeah, it was interesting. It kept me going, but it wasn't a major transformative event, because I do think that that gets oversold.
Yeah. I think what you said is vital as someone that serves ayahuasca. I could assure you every ceremony. I'm like, who's it going to be? Who's it going to be? There's at least one person that doesn't feel the medicine, right? I was that person. And I remember I was really frustrated. I remember telling the ayahuasca, I'm like, I've smoked cannabis stronger than this. Like, what am I doing here? It's like this. And the frustration comes because I understand people are coming for healing. And they do. They watch these videos or they hear folks and they have this is going to do it for me, right? This hope. And I understand that. I have the compassion for that. So same as me, I was like, this is it. This is going to heal me. And then if you have a mild experience or you don't have that transformative experience, it can be very devastating for folks. So yes, the results vary dramatically, drastically in a sense too. And a lot of folks don't understand with Aya, is again, a perfect example, similar to Bufo. For our serving signs, it's a tablespoon. Some people take a quarter of a tablespoon, they'll see the aliens. Other people could take 3 tablespoons, can have a complete conversation with you. It's not like an aspirin bottle where it's a, you know, 8 to 20, take one. It's not that dialed in. And that's the importance of having experience with working with these medicines, because it's very difficult to dial in the dose sometimes for folks. But it is such a wide, the standard deviation on the dose is all over the place.
Yeah, and it actually reminds me of what you were saying about this female shaman serving you the bufo in the first place, that this is also something that people sometimes on the outside, they might nitpick around, like, where are the standard serving doses and who's deciding who's taking what and how much. But there is sort of this intuitive element and also sort of the acceptance of, well, this is the situation that's arisen, so we're going to go with it. Where you're saying, look, I came here for DMT, man. Show me the fucking machine elves. She's like, no, we're all out of that. But you're here, and you're going to take some bufo. And you know, that does play a lot. It plays a major role in the way that a lot of people serve, where they say, look, I don't have an exact dosage that I'm giving you here, but I feel that you're ready for it. And like when I was going to the Santo Daime ayahuasca church, that's how they always served me. Like they would, you know, you get in line and they're giving different people different amounts. They're not giving everyone the same amount of ayahuasca. And it's not that they're sitting there and measuring it out carefully and like, well, let's look at your body mass. Let's look at your age. They're looking at you and they're saying, now fill his cup all the way. And then just give her a quarter cup, you know, so it plays a role. Plays a role.
For sure.
Okay. Moxie's asking to come back in now. So hold on 1 second. Let me take care of the dog. Okay, dog's back in. So now just the next thing that I wanted to pick up on was what you've shared about these initial bufo experiences of the difficulty around trying to articulate what the hell was that? But I know that something really huge just happened. And even in talking to the person who had been serving you ayahuasca and how she couldn't explain it, yet still, You got to try this. What's your thoughts on that at this point, having worked on the other end of this for quite a while now? How would you, in your own words, how would you describe what is the 5-MeO? What is the bufo experience? And what was it for you now with greater reflection and more time and more integration?
Okay, that's really good. Boy, it's tricky. So I'll explain it the way that I think I've experienced it versus how I would explain it to somebody that's maybe coming to it, because I've tried to steer away from any, I'm trying to keep it more vague for folks. I think when I first started serving, I'm like, this is what's happening, right? I felt pretty dialed into what was happening. I think the more and more I've done, I'm like, you have no clue. So let's not steer people towards any direction. Let them experience it however they experience it, and then allow them to sort that out. But for me, I feel, the science behind it shuts down the default mode network. What's left, right? So if your ego's gone, everything that makes Kirby Kirby, well, what's left? Again, my hypothesis is that's your soul, your spirit, your consciousness, whatever feels right, whatever words feel right. To me, 5-MeO feels like a near-death experience. But again, that's, You know, everything we're seeing through our own life filter, right? So I've always had interest in near-death experience. When I've had that experience, I feel like this is it. This is what happens essentially when you die. But from a more practical standpoint, I think what it did is it shut down the default mode network, which allowed my body to have a somatic experience, right? So I think as humans, you know, guy cuts you off in traffic, you get upset. We just store all that. We're not going back to homeostasis like other animals in the animal kingdom. We just store it. And I think that is one of the best opportunities when your ego is shut down for your body to finally have this somatic experience of releasing these energetic traumas. Right. Because I think everything is energy, and that includes trauma, your ego. All of it is just an energetic pattern. So it disrupts that energetic pattern by essentially shutting the ego down, which in my theory allows you to have this somatic release. I think that is one of the most underrated aspects of the medicine that you don't hear a lot of folks talking about. They're more talking about the experience, the oneness with everything, which is also important. So there's two pieces to it from my standpoint. That somatic piece, and then the experience when you're coming back online. And my first experience, I had no idea, but now, to me, as I'm coming back online, I feel literally, we all have egos, and if you view it as just this programming of just bricks, we've just built brick walls around ourselves. The 5MAO smashes that brick wall, but as it starts coming back online, brick by brick by brick, I'm able to see my ego, how I show up. Why do I want to say this to these folks? I remember one of my third experiences, there was a group of people, and as I'm coming out, I thought I was going to say something. And I'm like, why were you going to say that? Well, because you wanted to sound smart or say something funny to entertain. And it just showed me, I'm like, this is what you do. This is what you do. So to me, now I see it as technology that shows you your programming. And I also think, as inadvertently, it raises your level of consciousness. And I think by raising your level of consciousness, it gives you a little bit more play in your day-to-day life. I think people think they have more free will than they have. I think most people are really playing out heavy programming. But with your level of consciousness rising, then you're able to see these patterns, and then you can make choices versus just responding and reacting to it. So, yeah, I don't know. That's a long-winded answer to feel like it feels like a near-death experience to me. But again, in actuality, there's several parts to the experience, and I think all are important and all play a role in healing.
Yeah, well, you've mentioned a lot of things there that I'd like to kind of pick up on, and we can discuss a little bit more. The first is I want to get into this discussion of the default mode network, and this is something that's talked a lot about now in the psychedelic world, you know, with the research being done and showing, doing brain scans and showing that, look, when you take psychedelics, mostly what we're talking about is a disruption or modification of the default mode network, where they say, look, we can see that here's the normal brain, and information is being shared across these parts of the brain and in these patterns, and it's kind of in a rut, it's habitual, right? So that's the default mode network. Now, when we take psychedelics, what we see is that different parts of the brain start talking to each other in ways that they weren't talking to each other before. There's different patterns that are going on. There's novel forms of intercommunication. So that's where we have the quote unquote, the disruption of the default mode network. And this is where I think 5-MeO-DMT/BUFO is fundamentally unique, is that 99% of all psychedelic experiences, we're talking about a disruption of the default mode network. But the default mode network is still there. There's still associations. There's still an identity. There's still a perspective. But what happens with BUFO and 5-MeO is we get the complete override of the default mode network. And then there's this hypercoherence that happens within the brain with gamma wave production. And so that's where we're talking about the near-death experience of the complete dissolution of the sense of, as you say, Kirby, this the complete sense of Martin, and then we get to that, well, what's left over at that point? Yeah. And even there, I like that you mentioned that that's the point when we actually get all kinds of somatic experiences and releases happening in the body. And this can take place in terms of sort of an egoic unwinding and releasing that's taking place, then also the embodiment of symmetrical movements and spontaneous gestures that take place. And I agree that that's often overlooked, especially when people want to put it purely into the mental category of this is a realization, self-realization experience, right, versus this is still something that's happening in your body, and interesting stuff is really taking place there. And then also, as you say, I like to call it the backside of the experience, where you notice suddenly the default mode network is coming back online, and you become aware, oh, look, I have that pattern where I want to make a smart-ass quip, but what's driving that, right? So we actually get this opportunity to observe these aspects of ourselves that, as you say, most people are running around on unconscious programming most of the time, because this stuff is so ingrained in our default mode network. And even a disruption, such as with ayahuasca, a disruption of the default mode network is not necessarily going to clear it out.
No.
Yeah.
Especially for people, I think, just my opinion on it, heavy control issues. For me, that was it with ISO. Although I felt I was surrendering, I realized through 5-MeO that there's levels to surrendering, right? And that's why I felt it was my medicine. There was no conversation about surrendering. It's like, good luck resisting. And I realized I needed that. And to add to your point, that's the interesting part too. You nailed it. It's with all the other entheogens, even at ayahuasca ceremonies, when we're doing integration, I tell folks, be careful with that information. Your ego is still interpreting everything, right? It's still interpreting everything. So let's sit with that information before we start making any type of actions towards it. But for that reason specifically that you nailed it, your default mode network is still online. So therefore your ego is still playing a role in this interpretation.
Yeah. So kind of related to this question then, I'm interested if you could tell us a little bit more about this transition away from having a Christian business. And this is one of these really interesting points where, you know, I have promoted the idea that a 5-MeO DMT experience actually in its fullest form is fairly destructive towards religion.
Yes.
That if you're really being honest with yourself, you kind of come out of the experience with like, I don't need to be identified with any religion. That it just doesn't work for me anymore. And even though, you know, there are a lot of people who work in the field who want to use traditional non-dual traditions and kind of relate 5-MeO to those traditions, I've definitely been of the opinion that there's no perfect match. There's no perfect fit, because 5-MeO is its own thing. And so it doesn't really correlate with any religious or spiritual perspective that has been pre-existing on this planet, because they weren't developed from the 5-MeO experience. And so you had this in relationship to your own Christian identity. So I'm curious, could you tell us more about what that was like personally for you? Where did the pieces fall away? And what did you find that was taking its place, if anything?
Yeah, no, it just simplified it from that full experience, the I'm everything. I'm God. I'm one with the universe, whatever folks like to describe it at. Where I see so many memes about unconditional love, I'm like, have you experienced it though, right? So taking things from words and memes and having a full-bodied experience are significantly different. And that's the thing, like a lot of folks, I think in the spiritual community, I pick on them a little bit. For folks that haven't had this deep of an experience, there's a lot of words that we're tossing around, right? That we have an experience. So I know who's experienced unconditional love through the way that I have, because it will change you. And to me, that was the change of this doesn't seem like what Matthew, Mark, Luke, John are writing about. That doesn't seem like it would hate this person. That doesn't seem like it would wipe out everybody on the earth because they're not playing ball. They want them to play ball. This doesn't fit in alignment with any of these things I'm reading, but you want to hold on to that, right? And that's why probably you, same as me, we work with a lot of folks with this religious trauma, which I did not even know was a real term or a real thing until I went through my experience and could see the community associated to it. It creates a trap. There's so many traps in it, and I'm still supportive. I've got lots of family, friend. God bless you. I'm all for that religion. It just doesn't make sense to me anymore. I think it's bigger than that. I actually think that they're doing God a disservice. I think they're making God small when it's beyond that, if there is beyond that. So, and we can have different opinions on it. It dismantled that pretty quickly. Anything I read in the Bible afterwards that had anything to do that wasn't love and light, it didn't make sense to me anymore. And you nailed it. I warn people that have a heavy religious background, you should really strongly consider the ramifications of this afterwards, because I've almost served no one where it clicks. It's very tricky.
Yeah. So then in letting that stuff shed away, here's what I see as kind of another potential trap that people fall into is supplanting their prior religion with a new spiritual identity or a new spiritual belief. And so really what we get is a supplanting of what came before with something new, but it's a new configuration. And you know, you raised your hand, and I'll let you speak in a second. I went through the same thing in my own personal development as a human being. You know, I came from a secular background. And then when I got into psilocybin mushrooms, I was like, oh man, this shamanism thing is really, that this is obviously the thing. And, you know, and I got into spirit guides and, you know, ritual and ceremony and all of that. But what I did essentially was I created a new spiritual identity for myself. And that's what then I had to leave behind with my first full 5-MeO experience was like, oh shit, I guess I'm God. And the rest of this is just like, I've been masturbating with all of this. I've been having a good time. You know, this is not the diss on masturbation. You know, you can have a good time. And I was having a good time. It's like, but I've been telling myself stories. I've been creating an identity and a purpose and a sense of meaning for myself. And all of that just got obliterated. Yeah. So that's my share. So go ahead. You had your hand up. So.
Oh, I was just admitting that was my path too. And I think it's important for people to see that. I think people that, you know, do some of the work that we do, people look at you and have this fantasy of that your life, that you're Buddha, and you walk around and you're always, everything's perfect. And it's like, that's just not the reality. Right. But yeah, it's ego-based, and that's where you're going with it. So same as me, I had my experience. It blasted everything away that I had in the past, so then you start building something new. And I felt what it was being built on was that new community, right? I call it all the magical people, you know, these folks and the fan waivers and the spirit guides and all the entire spiritual community. I bought into that immediately of like, oh, that's what we do now. We wear beads and, you know, we talk to the trees and do all these things. So I did. I started creating my own persona that I believed in, right? And that's the interesting part is you destroy, you build, and then you continue to destroy and build until you hit one stage where it's like, what am I doing? And it starts going the opposite direction. So I love folks ask, you know, what are you? You know, are you a healer? Are you an ayahuasca? It's like, I'm just Kirby. Like, since 5-MeO, I've been spending most of my time trying to deconstruct all these roles and titles. I am nothing. Those are characters that I play when needed, right? I step in, you need, fine, I can be that. But I'm just Kirby. So that's what it did exactly. As I started picking up these personas, it started knocking them down like whack-a-mole. And it just shows you that all that is just ego. You're trying to create something that you can tell people that you are or show people that you are. Like, do you see me in all my specialness? And to me, that, again, part of the process is disassembling that and just ending back to where you and I have conversations of what I call energetically neutral. You just are.
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Yeah. And I really want to emphasize sort of the difference here in that you can deconstruct your persona. You can work on just being authentically yourself. And that doesn't mean that you can't run a ceremony. It doesn't mean that you can't develop an organization, that you can't play these roles.
Yes.
The difference is that you are not creating the roles as your identity and projecting that to others and then guarding and protecting it as I am this thing. I am this priest. I am this shaman. I am this light worker. I am this wonder person versus, look, I'm being myself. This is the way I'm facilitating it, or this is the way I'm working. This is how I'm helping other people access it. This is how I'm creating community around it. But in doing this, I am just being myself. That there is such a freedom to doing that. Because I think sometimes when people think about, you know, if I quote unquote overcome my egoic identity, then I'm just never going to do anything. and I'm just going to be totally passive and just not exist. And so I have to have some kind of egoic identity in order to have motivation. But, you know, there's still all, no matter what you're doing, there's always the ability and the need to continue to be yourself as long as you're alive, right? So it's just about how are you applying that and also how are you identifying that? So it's coming from either the identity or just sort of the liberated beingness of, well, yeah. And so this is where we're going to start talking about Wounded Healer Outreach and the Unchurch and all of that, because you have various roles that you play, but you're also kind of loose with it within yourself personally. I don't mean that you are loose or careless. I just mean that you've kind of, you're coming from this place of, look, well, I'm being Kirby. I'm being myself and I'm deconstructing this, but I'm still creating communities, still motivated by purpose, by mission, as you know, we might identify it. So yeah. So I invite us now to transition into talking about that, about what came first, the Wounded Healer Outreach or the Unchurch. Where would you like to begin there?
Yeah. Good question. I just want to hit that real quick because I think that's what we're doing, right? That's the work in general. And again, you're doing similar or identical work in the sense that when we're working with folks, it's like, I meet somebody for the first time, the first 5 minutes is them telling me what they are, right? Here it is. Doosh, just give me the package, right? This is I am. The goal is to deconstruct that with them, right? Are you that? And do you want to be that? Because I think most people are suffering is because they've created this identity, which is not in alignment with who they want to be, right? So they don't realize they played this programming out because they think they created it. Again, I would disagree. I think a lot of that has been programmed and it's just not in alignment with where they want to be. And that creates this huge disconnect. So that's the first 5 minutes, almost every conversation with folks is you tell me all these characters and roles that you are. You want a reaction from me. There's no reaction because I know that you're in there. You're not that. I know who's in there and it's not that. So to me, let's get to that. And I guess that trans, is a segue into the wounded healer, because I think that's the job there, essentially, or the role there is to help people discover their authentic self, whatever that means. And the only way to do that, I think, is, again, to see this programming. You know, even the Bible says, give me a boy for the first 7 years, I'll tell you the man he'll be. We know in the first 6 or 7 years of a child's life, they're in, I think, beta waves, which is hypnosis. So you're absorbing everything around you in your environment. Then you start becoming conscious and then you start playing that programming out, thinking it's your program. It is not. The faster folks can realize that, the more they have compassion for themselves, right? And can see, oh, I have been doing the best I can. Sheesh. Then you can have compassion for the guy next to you, right? Because like, oh, him too, right? We're all doing the best we can. And then you can start deconstructing some of those roles. So what started first was Wounded Healer Outreach. Again, because I was going to ceremony, my years of ceremony experience led me to be interested in integration because I felt that was something that I was missing out on. And so I wanted to create some sort of integration program. And then as I got more and more into the community, I wanted to create a program that would help folks decide what's a good route to go, where's a good place to go for ceremony, how do you find a safe ceremony, and then again, how do you go through that experience and then find the best way of integrating it? And I really enjoy that work, because like I said, you meet these folks for the first time, I love the stories, I'm listening, but in the back of my mind, I'm like, don't care, we're going to change all that, but you're going to change all that. So 5-MeO is the, to me, there's no question, is the best tool for deconstructing this programming and allowing folks to see who they really are and then make some alterations to that. I don't know if that answered your question. That was pretty long-winded.
Yeah, well, I'm going to follow up with reiterating from the question before, but I didn't want to jump on this point that you just made, that I really like the way that you've articulated it, that there is the story and the identity that people come with. And you and I both, we sort of share the same perspective, you know, having worked enough with BUFO, with 5-MeO DMT, of knowing that, well, actually, we can get you beyond all of this. And that as someone who facilitates, you literally can see when it happens. Yeah. You can see it in someone's face. You can see it in their body language. And you also feel that energetically. There's this sense of, hello for the very first time. Like, okay, you're actually here now, that you were participating in reality in a way that is not coming from the program. And, you know, whether that was picked up through society, through religious indoctrination, through your parents, through your childhood trauma, through your schooling, doesn't matter where it came from, but everybody's got it. And then that moment when someone actually breaks free. And so that's actually the how I created the tagline for the podcast, which is, have you met yourself yet? Mm-hmm. And that's what is meant by that, that perfect. Particularly through the vehicle of 5-MeO-DMT, we have the opportunity to actually meet ourselves for the very first time in the fully unconditioned state where we're just available to ourselves and to reality. And I just love that you've mentioned that, because I think it's something, it's so beautiful, it's so profound, and unfortunately I think it's something that most of the other medicines, they're not going to get you to that place. So people, this is again where people get a little defensive about it when you say, look, if you haven't had this experience on 5-MeO, you probably haven't gotten there yet. That some people can be defensive about that and feel like, oh, you're dismissing my experience. It's like, no, this is just objectively what we can say about this is the difference. This is why 5-MeO is so uniquely special, because it allows for this true arrival into yourself. And even there, I like to characterize it as it coming into yourself here, because sometimes the metaphors get taken the other way. I got blasted out into the universe. I completely left my body. And I always like to, you know, bring it back to, actually, I want you to be yourself right here, right now. We can blast the construct away, but really the goal is to have you be here as you are. And it's just such a beautiful moment when that takes place for people.
Yeah. And again, this will probably upset folks, but I feel I'm in a position to say it. There's a drastic difference in the experiences. I mean, it's not even close. So to me, you know, again, I have ceremonies with ayahuasca. I can't help myself. I'm sure I'll get in trouble for saying this, but as I'm going through ceremony and I'm like, that's a bufo person. That's a bufo person, right? You just know, or you have this sense, like you said, this understanding of how it's going to be taken and who would it be effective for. And again, a lot of folks is people that are struggling with some sort of control, but it's the only medicine that is going to shut down that default mode network in the way that you mentioned earlier, that will allow you to truly see yourself. I can't stress the importance of that. I mean, you can do all the medicines you want. And you're right, whenever I mention this, oh yeah, I did mushrooms once and I had that experience. Maybe. I did ayahuasca once and I had that experience. And I'm like, well, what is the experience? Well, I remember I was one with everything. And I'm like, that's not the experience. There's no I in my experience. There is just the experience. So yeah, and that's not with any disrespect to the other medicines. I think they're extremely valuable, but I think getting your bufo glasses, just having this raise in consciousness, having this raise in awareness of actually touching your authentic self for that one time, like you said, it gives you a sense of reality that you just can't, it'd be very difficult to get somewhere else. And that helps, again, view these other entheogens, these other experiences, I think, with a proper lens. Yeah. But yeah, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I also share that opinion. I like to say that, look, the full non-dual experience on 5-MeO will put everything else into perspective. And yes, it's actually not possible to put everything else in perspective until you've gone beyond all perspectives. And yes, that's when you start to understand, oh, like, again, reflecting on myself, like, oh, all that stuff I was doing with my spirit guides and all of that and ceremony, that was all just me creating an identity for myself. But when you're in it, it feels so powerful. It feels so real. It feels so meaningful, you know, and that's a big one, that the ego is addicted to meaning. I want stuff to mean stuff because that feeds my sense of purpose and identity. And when you go beyond all of it and you realize, I've made up all the meanings. Oh my God, that was me. I did that. It puts it in perspective, and you can't get that anywhere else that I've ever seen.
No. And to your point with the work that we're doing, again, that's the whole concept of Wounded Healers, is take people that are struggling, whatever it is, PTSD, trauma, who doesn't want to have a higher level of consciousness, I think, but is giving folks that experience. And again, once they see that, then they'll do the work. It's almost like a performance enhancing drug, right? Like I'm too skinny to do steroids, obviously, but I'm assuming those guys that take steroids still have to drink all the protein shakes, eat all the food, lift all the weights, right? It just doesn't make them bigger. It's the same as these medicines. It's just it gives you an opportunity to really slide into some of these spaces that you would not have an opportunity to slide into and work them and really speed up this ability to heal yourself. And again, that feel of compassion. How many folks do you talk to where you know the prescription for them is self-love? And you can say love yourself till you're blue in the face. They're never going to love themselves. But there's something about that experience that will elicit that, where there's this amount of self-love and compassion that's it, Mark. I mean, that's like, what more do we need to do for folks? That is like the starting point for all healing, in my opinion. And I don't know else how you could have that experience. Again, there's other ways, but it's, to me, this is, from an efficiency standpoint, I don't know a better way of doing it. But yeah, you can't heal people until they let go of all these identities, until that is broken down and they can see them as roles. Like you said, we have roles, right? You have a role. It's, to me, it's a costume I'm putting on for that act. Okay, all right, I've got the podcast. What, and action, right? Out the door. But it's not anything that I cling to. I don't need it. I'm not it. It's just a role. So I think people are exhausted by pretending to be all these characters that they don't know that they're pretending to be. It's got to be exhausting trying to think who you need to be in the moment, right? Versus just, you just are.
Yeah.
You just are.
And it so makes that self-love that you're talking about, it makes it inaccessible because it keeps it trapped in conditionality. As long as we are trapped in our roles, then it becomes, I can love myself when I perform my role well. I can love myself when I can perform my role so that other people value and praise me for my role. I can't love myself when I perform my role poorly, because then I'm open to criticism, judgment, shame, and blame. And then the trick is, when we go beyond all of that, that we realize, oh, I am love. That's what I am. It's totally up to me to love myself unconditionally, not based on what I'm doing or who I'm pleasing, including myself. That it's about being what I already am. And that's where I also like to say, just very much in symphony with what you're saying here, that for me, that's the fundamental question for anyone is, do you love yourself unconditionally? And, you know, often when I ask people that, sometimes people just start crying like right away and they're like, but no, I don't. And then even that becomes another layer, because then I am now critical of myself for not loving myself unconditionally. And so I'm bad, right? Yeah. So that's a condition. And so having these tools that take us beyond all conditionality are just invaluable. And I'm totally in agreement that I think that 5-MeO-DMT is the express route.
Yeah. And in your opinion, has there been a more important time in history for this? I mean, what is social media? It's a platform of, am I important enough, right? Am I important enough? So we've created a society where, you know, your likes are really going to be a determinant of your mental health. And I just think that is an issue where all the feedback you're getting is from an outside source. You're doomed. So again, having this opportunity to see yourself in an authentic fashion and realize not only what you are, but what everybody else is, right, allows you to navigate these folks. I mean, I always use the advice or the quote, like, I love my daughter. She's 5. I was a financial advisor for 25 years. If she gave me financial advice, I would thank her, but I'd say, she doesn't know what she's talking about. But yet most of us go through our entire existence listening to what I call the theys and thems, the theys and thems. Worry about the theys and thems. I'm like, I could assure you from serving this medicine, most folks don't know who they are. So why would you listen to them telling you who they think you are? Right. So it's like listening to a 5-year-old give you financial advice. I'm like, thank you. Good day to you. Right. But that's something that a lot of folks haven't had access to. But I think it's important to get to that.
Yeah. And I would agree that it's the right medicine for the right time. And, you know, it's sort of this interesting question, like, why weren't people more interested in 5-MeO before, like, right now? And I do think actually it's the integrating nature of what's happening through electronics and social media and sort of cross crossing of borders and political ideologies where, you know, some asshole in Europe makes a tweet and sparks a riot in South America, you know, whatever it may be, that we are all so hyper interconnected, and that we're all propping up these really fragile public performative versions of ourselves that we've kind of all become one in the sense of the global economy and the global information and communication network, yet we're still writing out these programs and these very, very fragile identities that want there to be heroes and want there to be victims and want to be righteous and overcome the bad, whatever it may be. And we all want secret knowledge to have insights into what's really going on so that we could be on the right side of history and the right side of the social and political spectrum and all of that. That, like, let's just drop a truth bomb into the middle of it and let's not even engage in the discourse. Let's just drop the bomb right in the middle. And then let's pick up the pieces after that. And that's what I think that 5-MeO really is for humanity.
Yeah, I think, you know, from the standpoint of, where was I going with this? I had a thought on this. I'm sorry. Yeah, I lost my train of thought. I apologize.
All right. Well, let me go back to this question and then... as you talk about something else, I'm sure it'll come back to you. But so with
wounded, I remember. I'm sorry. I'm going to cut you off.
Okay,
I'm
good.
Forget it again.
Jump on it.
Yeah, I think that's the importance of some of the work and some of the conversations we have. Right? Is because this medicine is so powerful. The ability to change folks in a very short period of time is something that my first journey, again, I knew immediately the power and the danger of this type of medicine. So I guess that is the one concern you mentioned, you know, it's becoming more and more popular. And again, that's the importance from my standpoint to do more and more of these talks is folks need to be aware of it, what it can do, good and bad, who to look out for, who to look for. Because again, this is becoming more and more popular. And from what I'm seeing online, and we could have hours of conversations about the folks that I watch serve, and then I could be a little critical of it. I'm like, I don't know if that's safe. But I do. I think that's an important thing as we move forward for folks to understand that as impactful as this is, you know, my website, one of the videos I have is who should not do it or why not to do it, right? Because it isn't for everybody because it is so powerful. But I think because of its power, it's very important to make sure that you get it done right and safely.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. So I wanted to return back to Wounded Healer Outreach. That you kind of talked a little bit about it, but I guess something that was still unclear to me was, so who is Wounded Healer Outreach for? What is we have, so I have my browser open and you have two web pages that I've got here. We have Wounded Healer Outreach, and then we also have the Unchurch. So we haven't even talked really about the Unchurch yet, but, so is Wounded Healer Outreach, is that more of your personal practice and to working directly with clients who are looking for addressing life issues, trauma, self-development? I'll let you tell about it.
No, that you did it better and shorter than I would have. So yes, that's exactly it. That's for the integration, folks that want to work with a coach, mentor, those types of things. So that's really the things outside of the church. The church is, the Unchurched was set up to allow us to facilitate these medicines, the 5-MeO and ayahuasca. And then if folks need additional support after that, integration, or again, they just want to work with somebody ongoing, I do that through Wounded Healers Outreach. So that would be the difference in the two. Yeah.
Okay. So that's woundedhealeroutreach.com. And it's all presented as one word, no spaces or dashes anywhere in there. So anyone who wants to go check out Kirby for that particular function, just go to woundedhealeroutreach.com. Okay, so now let's get into the Unchurch, and what an unceremonial name. Let's even just start with the name. Where does the Unchurch come from? Which is a great name, by the way.
Thank you. We get a lot of heat for it. But I think that's telling me what I need to hear. Yeah. And again, I have nothing but, again, because through this work, you see the nature of how folks are. I have nothing against anybody, whatever religious affiliation you have. I support it. It just isn't for me. But through the work, what I've been finding is some of the negative effects of organized religion. And again, that's some of this religious trauma. So having to be in the church space from a legal standpoint and having to call it a church just didn't sit right. It was a weird, it was a strange place to be because I wanted folks to feel safe and I wanted to let them know that this is different than a traditional church. You know, I was actually, did a PBS show a little while back and the whole point was about community. So the other person speaking was, had created a community group for non-religious people, right? Because the thought was the religious community, they have their community. And as soon as you start disagreeing with that, you're kind of tossed out of the club. And that creates a lot of issues, as you can imagine. So folks stick it out, they ride it out, they convince themselves of it because they don't want to lose the community. And this group had a non-religious community. And to me, I'm like, well, I see flaws with both those. Well, what if you're in the non-religious community, you start becoming religious. You get tossed out of that too. The unchurch is, it's just that. It is an open platform for folks that regardless if you want to use these sacraments or not, it's an open place regardless of your religious beliefs and all the other things. But it's an opportunity that, again, that we've created a platform where we can serve these sacraments and these medicines in a safe and more legal fashion.
So then tell us about how does that work? How does that take place? What is a typical service of the unchurch?
Yeah.
And how do people participate?
Yeah, so folks meet us online. We have a place in Denver that we serve once a month, and then we have a place here in Des Moines, Iowa that we serve once a month. Although we have legal status, the analogy I use is, and maybe this isn't the best analogy, but when cannabis was legal, you know, decrimmed in California years ago, the DEA was still kicking in their doors. So although we have the legal status, we still try to be as low-key as possible, just not to draw a bunch of attention to ourselves. So we keep our locations pretty discreet, but we do. We do two IA ceremonies each month, and then we'll do a, we used to do group UFO. I've moved away from that. I find it to be, I prefer it one-on-one or individuals. It's just, it's, for a multitude of reasons I won't get into, but yeah, so folks reach out to us. We have a pretty hefty process in a good way. We've got a doctors on staff, psychiatrist on staff. So if folks are on medications, we take them through that route to see what, how they can safely step into ceremony or if they can step safely step into ceremony. And then we spend time obviously getting prep for the, depending on what the ceremony is. So yeah, we do it, like I said, we do two ceremonies each month, and then we do the BUFO ceremonies periodically when individuals request it. And that has been the largest request in the last 4 months, have been more folks interested in the 5-MeO. And I do see a pretty heavy transition from folks from ayahuasca to wanting to do 5-MeO as well.
Yeah. So yeah. In creating the structure of the church, so if we go to, so the website is the Unchurch Church. It's great. TheUnchurchChurch.com. It's all one word. Let's see. We do have, maybe it's under the about. Let's see. Yeah, we have the section, what we believe. The Unchurch was built to help people heal and connect with their authentic self through community and plant medicine sacraments. So, you know, as I've had other lawyers and people working on entheogenic religions here on the podcast, and we've talked about how for the DEA and for the federal government, they want to see some kind of doctrine from any kind of church. We say, we want to know what you believe. And so here we're kind of in this almost Zen koan like church, because it's the unchurched church. And so when it comes down to what we believe, so how did you go about creating this statement of beliefs around something that ultimately is very open-ended? And it really points to, I think, the sort of this paradoxical nature that we're dealing with here. Like, and I get this all the time because all my books I write, I'm writing about God, like all the time. I'm talking about God all the time. And then people come and they ask me like, okay, so what religion do you belong to? Or what's your spiritual practice? And I says, well, I don't have any. It's like, my job is just to be myself. That's what I do. And I'm very interested in God, but I'm not a religious person. I'm also not a spiritual person. At least not in any conventional sense of what that would mean. So yeah, how do you create a statement of beliefs for something that is what it isn't?
First off, get good attorneys. That's the advice to anybody that wants to step into that platform. Get a good attorney. Mine's Sean McAllister. He's in Colorado. He's phenomenal. But you know, working with him to draft that. But the difficulty, you nailed it. I find it fascinating that, again, we're looking for protection under the Freedom of Religion Act, but we've accepted all these other religions, right? Like Christianity, no question. Really? No question? We don't have any questions about that religion, right? Or any of these that pass. And to me, look, I've done 5MEO almost 200 times. Like, I feel like I've experienced God more than most people on the planet, probably more than Matthew, Mark, Luke, John combined, right? So we'll take their word for it, right? You can't Google search them. You can't look at their Facebook page. You can't Instagram them. But we're just going to take their word for everything. And then now that is the basis for religion in our country, in the sense that if you're not doing anything based on that, something's wrong with you, you're outside of the norm. That alone should just be something that should fascinate folks, that is the platform that is based on. So that essentially there is very few other religions that are acceptable, but the fact that, so either get rid of it all, right, or accept them all. To accept that as truth and everything else as a lie is just very strange to me from the position I'm in now. You know what I mean by that? So it's a tricky spot. And I had that conversation with people all the time. Again, I'm very comfortable with what you want to believe, but I should have the freedom to believe what I believe. And I've had a direct experience. Not many people that I know that when I was going to church had a direct experience, right? So we're just in a strange place with as far as the law is concerned, and you're starting to see that shift. There's ayahuasca church down in Florida called Soul Quest. They've been battling the DEA on some things over the last couple of years. And it seems the DEA has been a little silent. So my guess is that they're probably working on some protocols or how to move forward, because right now the platform of Christianity is really the religion and that's it. It's just not working anymore. And people just aren't buying into that. So it's a tricky process to answer your question. But again, we sit down with the right attorneys. We spent the time, the money, the resources to make sure that, how we feel about this sacrament. And to me, it is a sacrament. If you want to connect with God, go to Sunday service and listen to this guy talk to you, or you can come to my house, right? And I could assure you within 15 minutes, you will know what God is, and it's you.
Yeah. And I really love sort of this interplay between direct experience, knowledge, and then what we're calling belief. And I think that this is one of the big hangups around religion in the United States, that as a shorthand in the United States, we often refer to religion as faith-based traditions, or about your sacred beliefs or your deeply held religious beliefs and convictions. And so we actually, coming from this Judeo-Christian Islamic background, we overemphasize the concept of belief, and so much so that most Americans tend to think that religion and belief are the same thing. And, you know, I was a religious studies professor for many years, and I had one of the books that we used in class mentions Shinto religion in Japan, and it specifically says in the book, if you were to go and ask any Shinto priest what people believe in Shinto, they would not have anything they could tell you. They would have no answer to that question because they don't even think in terms of belief. So that's a completely foreign concept, yet we want to recognize that Shinto is a religion.
Interesting.
Okay? And then, you know, a friend and colleague of mine, Mike Crowley, who is an ordained lama in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, his joke is that, well, when people ask me what Buddhists believe, my answer is always as little as possible.
I love it.
You know, and these are just, you know, it's a little quip, but it shows us that the whole concept that religion and belief are the same thing, or that if you are religious, you must have a set of beliefs, is problematic because it's very much culturally biased. It doesn't reflect what's happening globally. And then we get into these problems of, well, what's the difference between belief and direct experience? And does direct experience produce knowledge? Is knowledge the same thing as belief? And I think that we're also sort of culturally at a point where people equate any anything that you want to say, this is what is real. Everyone wants to say, well, that's just your opinion, and we have to tolerate all opinions because all opinions are just opinions and they're all equally valid and all equally potentially untrue. Yet direct experience is something different than just belief, and certainly different than faith. So it's this weird interplay of, like, how do we do the dance to create a church that has a statement of beliefs but is actually based on direct experience? And, you know, this is something that's coming up with the Church of Silo-Methoxen, which I've had a couple of interviews now on the podcast about. Their church is very non-doctrinal, and it is very open and ecumenical, meaning that it doesn't really matter what you believe, because this is about the experience of connecting with the sacrament. So it's just a complete different orientation around the idea of what religion can or should be, or what a church can or should be.
Yeah, but that's it's important, again, because as we mentioned earlier, I had my experiences, and I thought I knew things. Dismantled those, thought I knew more things, dismantled them. I don't know how long that process lasted for you, but, you know, I was doing what essentially you coined the non-dual energetic therapy, which is how we met. I did my ceremonies, then started watching some of your work, and it just clicked like a light bulb. I'm like, oh, that's what I've been doing inadvertently for myself. And it made sense. I'm like, that's actually what is happening. What he says will happen has already happened. This is the right track. But you nailed it. The important piece is to, until you can let all those things go, you can't rebuild, right? It's as much, you know, the old analogy, it's as much as unlearning it is learning. So as you go through these processes, it's very normal to pick up on these things like, oh, I'm this now. I went through all of these things, or I know something, I have an experience. I'm like, I know this now, right? And I would tell people, I believe, you know, reincarnation, or this is what happens when we die, because I had this maybe a mild experience, and my belief, right, took over that experience and corrupted it, right? And it just gets to a point, I think, the more and more, or the work you do, I don't know. Like, you feel we are everything. There is nothing outside of us. There is no reincarnation. There's no maybe, right? I think along those same lines, I'm like, but maybe there's reincarnation. Maybe we come back. I don't know. So I just think it's important for me personally, that people acknowledge that I don't know, right? People expect that we know. It's like, I don't know. I haven't died. I don't know yet, but I've got theories, right? And I've got beliefs, and I've got all these things, but all of that has been built for the first 50 years of my life, right? So I think that's a great point. So now, as we're working with folks, I really try to emphasize, I don't know. I don't know. I'm curious what your experience is going to be. And as you said, their experience is going to be interpreted based on this past history.
Yeah. And I think what's so powerful here is that the more one really goes through this process and does this work and goes through that, I like to call it the liberation through unknowing, is not that you necessarily come out the other side saying, okay, this is definitely true, this is definitely not true. But what becomes clearer and clearer as you go through it is like, oh, I was using that to prop up my belief about myself. I was using that to create an identity for myself. I was using that to limit myself, or I was using that to create meaning for myself. And that becomes more and more and more apparent. And so that's where sort of the agnosticism starts to come in. It's like, maybe there are these things going on. But you know what? What I do know is that I previously used my perception of that to create an identity of myself, that I was this past incarnation, and so therefore this means something for me now. I see that actually I was using that, and so that's what I'm letting go of. And then, yeah, you remain open, but then you also center on, well, what is my experience here now? You know, and
but that's important that you clarify that, because I think that's why, if I was somebody listening to this podcast and thought, I'm going to have an experience, I would like somebody to help me with it, that's why you would be the person for me, right? Or somebody like myself. My concern is, again, because I'm involved in the world of therapists and this whole conglomerate of folks that are working, doing their best, you see a lot of what I call fake magic, right? So again, this will probably get me in trouble. Your past life caused X, Y, and Z, or, you know, your spirit, because there's no facts around it. I find that we're able to utilize these little spiritual bags of tricks, so to speak, to make yourself special, hired, necessary, needed, and seen, right? Like, oh, I got to work with Jim because he told me I was the Pharaoh in my past life and he's going to help me work with. That is my concern. So it's important for folks, again, we have a very similar opinion. I don't think there's anything outside of ourselves. So if folks also agree with that, again, if you're looking to have these experiences, understand how you're going to get it integrated. Because that is my concern with, again, some of the folks outside of there is that specialness. Like you mentioned, I used it in the past too. Then I saw it and stopped using it. Some are still using it and it could be detrimental.
Yeah. And it's so, so tempting. You know, it really feeds the ego. It really feeds identity, to feel special. Cause we're human beings. We're burdened and blessed with this complex self-awareness that we know that we exist. And because of that, we all want to be loved. We all want to feel special. We all want to feel like we know something. We all want to have a sense of meaning and a sense of purpose. And, you know, so it's natural. I mean, it's important to recognize that's a natural part of being human, but we're also addicted to these things as well. And that when we find other people that can feed us more of that, then we start to give our power to them. This person knows something special and secret that I don't know, and they're going to work with me on this. And maybe even I'm going to become one of these people as I go through this process. And then I will be special and I will have secret knowledge and I will help usher people in through the gateways into, you know, this beautiful spiritual world. And it all just keeps coming back around, feeding on itself. And so that's why it's beautiful when we can just kind of go beyond that and sort of rest in that and then start over from that place. And I think that we both agree that's where 5-MeO really plays the most significant role.
Yeah, and I think important to go back to the safety piece is when you're interviewing folks to do this medicine with, you got to find that out, right? Like if you're working with somebody that thinks they're special, I would flee. That means they probably need to do more of their own medicine. And I've seen these folks, and I'm sure you have too. I've seen a YouTube video. I'm like, that guy needs to do some bufo, right? What is that? So it's dangerous in that standpoint. But I think the folks that understand that molecule, have worked with that molecule, and really have a connection with it, understand that for you to facilitate that, you need to be able to step into that space and be what I call energetically neutral, drop all those roles and titles that like, are they seeing me? Am I special? Here's my whole song and dance. I find the more props you need, probably the less qualified you are, right? But again, that's not a big deal if it wasn't detrimental, but I'm starting to see it becoming detrimental in the standpoint that for all the reasons you mentioned, that's the person that could help me. They're it. They have the answer. They have the knowledge. They have the wisdom. And again, we've created this on social media where it's a very tempting thing for folks to step into. And I understand why they do it. But again, I'd say they probably needed a little bit more medicine because it shook that right out of me very early on.
Yeah. So speaking of social media context and all of that, I mean, obviously you've got your couple websites that we have here. I know you're also doing a podcast, which we should spend some time talking about. You've got some group pages on Facebook, where you work with people and connect with people there. But kind of one of the things that really stands out, and we can talk more about sort of the online presence, but I'm very curious just to talk for a minute about Des Moines, Iowa, because this is, you're one of the few people that I've ever talked to that is working with these modalities, like in the Midwest of the United States. There's, you know, Denver, Colorado, that's already been happening there. Oregon, it's happening. Washington, California, it's totally happening. New York, Florida, you know, on the edges, it's totally happening. But now here we are, Des Moines, Iowa. What? So if you could share a little bit about, you know, having the Unchurch in Des Moines, it's hard. It's hard to imagine. So I'm just curious what we have to say about that.
It's the road here was pretty interesting. When I was training, I was one of the folks I was training with was a doctor in psychiatry. He was a psychiatrist for 35 years, did IO once, and the medicine told him that he should rip up his prescription pad. And then he met somebody that served 5-MeO, learned that, and that's all he did. And their pattern was they'd show up to a city, like I met him in Chicago, And we would do one person every hour for 10 hours. And we do that for a week straight. And then we go to the next town, then the next town, and the next town. It's a great way to get trained because you're going through a significant amount of people in a very short period of time. So you're able to see those experiences and learn to protect folks. But to me, what was missing was the community. We would serve these folks. They'd have this massive experience and they're back into the matrix. I remember serving a guy. He's like, I'm gonna get back on the metro and take it. I'm like, you're getting into traffic right now and you're gonna fight the commute to go. Like, what are we doing? And so as the more and more I did that, the more and more I started to understand the importance of community, especially around this molecule, because it's so rare, it's so different, it's going to change you in levels. You need folks to that could relate on some level. So yeah, my daughter was born, she's 5, and at that stage we decided that the traveling just wasn't a good fit anymore. And I was missing out on all the community connections. I'd show up, I'd serve, I'd have some beautiful interactions with folks, and then I'm gone, right? And I'm like, yeah, I kind of missed that. So it just made sense to do it here. And because I also early on the training, I remember trying to get the shaman to come here. He was from Mexico. And I was like, well, would you come to Iowa? He's like, yeah. And I was like, well, let me show you the weather report for the next 6 months. He's like, and he's like, you need to do it. And essentially, that's what happened. The guy that ended up training me specifically for the Midwest. He's like, we got Chicago covered. We need folks there. And so that began that. And it's been life altering in the sense that, again, the community that we've created out here is just unbelievable. You name it, all from politicians down to, you know, to every walk of life. We've got everybody covered. We have events all the time. You know, it's amazing to have an event, 40, 50 people show up. Nobody's drinking. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but a lot of these folks were struggling with that. So to be able to show up and just be and wanting that event to happen for a significant period of time, it's pretty incredible. So yeah, the move mostly for my daughter, but also again, I was feeling this lack of community and I wanted to build something that I could be a part of as well. So we brought it to the Midwest. Yeah.
Yeah. So when did you tie it into social media and online and also developing your podcast?
Yeah, if anybody is looking at the web pages or the Facebook page, they know I'm a 50-year-old guy. It looks like a 50-year-old guy has done all of the websites probably haven't been updated in a while. The Facebook I try, but I'm very I'm not a huge fan of social media for a million reasons, right? It feels like this necessary evil for a lot of people. So really, I feel like we have to have these presences on some level, but I'm really trying to outsource more and more to some of the folks that I work with so they could handle it and do more with it. But again, since what happened in Colorado, the decrim of some of these medicines, more and more groups have popped up. So I've had more and more people try to spur me on to get out there, be known. I mean, our background, I got trained through a Teratan, and it's a trauma-informed plant medicine facilitator, which again goes through all the understandings of trauma so you can step into these spaces and serve folks without not re-traumatizing them. So we have a unique skill set, and the way that we serve is unique. It'd be egoic to say that it's important for people to have that. I don't think that's the case, but I want to be an access point for folks that do need that and would like it done in the fashion that we're doing it at. So that's the social media. We started the Entheogenic Explorers podcast, really a selfish play so I could have folks like you on and have great conversations and really just stay in active in this community as it continues to grow. I think we're on the cutting. It's about to take off. You're the one of the founders of all the platform up to now. Obviously going to be a role in it moving forward, but it's about to take off in some major ways. So part of me, and again, probably sounds like an egoic statement, feels like we just need to let folks know that there's safe ways to do it. And that doesn't mean that it's through us necessarily, but how do you do these molecules, these medicines, these sacraments safely so you can actually get some healing and not be traumatized? And again, back to your question, I felt the safest way of doing that is being part of that community and being involved in it versus the way I was trained. We serve. Good luck. Good luck. Good luck to you too, sir. Good luck, ma'am. And I think there's better ways of doing it. So that's what we've tried to implement here.
Awesome. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground in our talk today. Kirby, is there anything that you feel that I haven't asked you about that you wanted to share, or any final thoughts that you want to share with the audience?
More. I'll toss one question. Maybe we'll go back to the closing. I think this is a piece that we've had conversation on. I'd love to hear your explanation for folks, because I probably... So we talk about some of the folks in the spiritual community, and we talk about some of what I call the pretend magic, fake magic. Maybe it's real. I don't know. What is your thoughts? Again, can you verbalize just your overall theory or your feelings on we are just everything. There is nothing outside of ourselves. There is no tree spirit. There is nothing. What do you think all that is? So I guess that would be the question. What do you think all these outside entities are, these spirits that folks are connecting with? Yeah, what is your theory on what's happening there?
Yeah, so at the basic level, I like to refer to all of that as experiences of the divine imagination. So this is something that I first articulated in my 2009 book, Being Human, where I'm kind of dealing with... So kind of looking at this fundamental question that in that book of Being Human, I said, look, people want to know what all these spirits and all this stuff is. And we keep asking, well, what is that? What is that? And what I want to do is I want to turn the question around so that we're not asking, what is that? We're asking, what is the nature of the one that is perceiving and having this experience that thinks that this thing exists outside of itself? So for me, the question is, what does it mean to be a human being? Now, through my experiences with 5-MeO, I'm fully convinced that a human being is a direct physical embodiment of the universal consciousness that is everything for all space and all time, eternally, forever, infinitely. So in other words, we are all God that experiences ourselves as the limited form that we are. And so this is why when we are able to, so we have our normal human imagination, right? Where I can say, well, I can imagine that the tree is a rocket ship and I can imagine that it's taking off into space. But, you know, as I'm looking at it in my normal everyday human consciousness, it's still just a tree. And I know that I'm imagining that. But if I take psychedelics and I actually alter the neurotransmitter makeup that is flowing through my body, right? So it's a very physical thing that's taking place, that I could start to imagine not only is that tree a rocket, but it's also a multi-armed octopus with a million eyes, and it's actually coming to get me right now, so that we can superimpose far more fantastical imagery onto either exterior reality, or if we close our eyes, then, you know, we start to see all of this stuff. And, you know, one of the things that people often say is like, look, that was not my imagination, because there's no way I could have imagined that. That did not come from my personal history. That was nothing that I personally know or have ever experienced. Yet this is what I saw and experienced. And so that's where I like to use the term, well, that's the divine imagination. And that because we are all this universal consciousness that has played every single person that has ever lived and every person who's alive now and every living being that has ever been has actually been this one being performing as those, that there's this vast reservoir of imagination, of form, and of shape, and of intelligence that exists beyond our normal human consciousness and our normal human imagination. And so when we alter our neurotransmitter makeup, we're actually able to access this. And so I say, look, that's just your experience in the divine imagination. But the divine imagination primarily functions as an interactive and responsive mirror. So if I'm feeling really alienated from myself and my experience, I might see some aliens. If I'm feeling like showing myself divine love and forgiveness, I might see Jesus. And, you know, as long as we're interacting in that space, it very much seems like this is something that exists outside of me. And I love it. I tell people, it's like, look, whenever you come across an entity, if you get a chance to ask it, who are you? And the funny thing is that when people do that, the answer is always, I'm you. It's always, always the same answer, I'm you. And so then that invites the person to ask, well, then what the fuck am I? If that's me, what am I? And so this is why I like to say that, look, there's kind of a misunderstanding that a lot of people, when they think of the ego, they think that my ego is just my sense of myself, of me, and then there's everything else out there. But I say, look, the ego actually resides on the interface between my perception and conception of myself, and also the ego creates everything that exists outside of what is thought to be the self, so that the ego actually creates self and not self at the same time. It creates me and not me at the same time. It creates I am in some weird psychedelic space, and I am now interacting with a machine elf that is not me. But all of that is the ego. And this is why, going back to a point we made earlier, it is not possible to get clarity on any of those events until you completely transcend the subject of I am experiencing this, that, or the other thing into the pure experience of this is it, right? Where we can't even describe it in that moment. And then afterwards we can say, wow, I just experienced myself as God. And that's not even I was one with God, because there's still two there. If I was one with God, that's still two. It's just, there's nothing but this universal being. And so once we've had that experience, then we can start to understand how, I'm creating myself and other at the same time. And then when we get into metaphysical beings, what I always like to point out is that those metaphysical beings, none of them have a body. That the only thing that creates coherence is physicality, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, I can have a vision that I grew wings and flew away off into the cosmos. But when the tryptamine runs out, I'm not going to have wings anymore. Now, if I were able to grow wings in physical reality, I guarantee you they would still be there tomorrow when I wake up. And so all of these are projections. They only exist in the moment of them being perceived or experienced. So they don't have any objective continuity to them. And so that's also where I like to make a difference between dreams, visions, and then physical reality, that these are phenomenologically and ontologically distinct and different. And it's really important that, you know, that you've probably heard this, where people, they have a quote-unquote enlightenment experience. It's like, wow, all of reality is a dream. It's all an illusion. None of it's real. It's all just a dream. And I always say, look, dreams are totally different than everyday life. They're ontologically and phenomenologically different. Reality is not a dream. There might be certain levels of projection and illusion that take place in our perception and conceptualization of it, but it's not a dream. It's not an illusion. Okay, so that's my short, long answer about all of that.
It's perfect. And the reason I had you say this is just because, I guess, in closing, I guess just maybe a message to anybody out there that's listening. I'm assuming most folks that listen to your podcast already have some familiarity with this molecule, have done it. If you haven't, and you have curiosity about it, do some research first and foremost. You've got a lot of material that I highly recommend. But I'm in a world now, being retired, that the majority of the folks I see are just surviving. They're just surviving. And I think folks have an opportunity with this molecule to change that trajectory. And it's not just changing yourself. It saved my life. There's no question. And in turn, it saved my wife's life, which saved my son and my daughter and my best friends and my neighbors now. It's serious. It has serious implications in a positive way if done right. No, it's not for everybody, but if you're somebody out there that's just surviving, consider it. Find somebody qualified. Sit down with this sacrament. But again, do some research on it. It could be life-changing. And, you know, what we're trying to do as a group is create more access for it legally and really keep going down that rabbit hole with the attorneys and fighting the big fight, so to speak, because everybody should have access to this because it will change you. So there's my message. Check us out. Again, I'm not for everybody. We try to do it the best that we can. We're trauma-informed. We really try to create platforms and situations so folks get healing from it. It's not about just having an experience. We're not looking to serve those folks. We're looking to serve folks that have been struggling and they've tried everything else. And I find this is a great place for this molecule for some folks that have tried everything else and they're just desperate. That's where I was when I went to it. And I always say, those are my people where, yes, the first time I did, I was scared. But I'm like, I'm going to die. I'd rather die in this dirt than go home being the person I was. Those are my people. So if you feel like that, reach out. And if not to me, reach out to you. Reach out to somebody that can get you some more information and let you know that there is hope. I've served hundreds of people, probably close to 1,000, if not more. The stories can go on and on. You see them all on YouTube. It's life-changing. Again, if done right and integrated properly. And if you had an experience, you need to get it integrated. Again, I do recommend you, sir, for all the reasons that we just discussed. And if you're not available, I'd say put me number two on that list to have folks that could help you get through this experience, make sense of this experience without getting in the way. And getting in the way is shoving their ideas, their specialness, their theories, their philosophies in the way of your interpretation of it. I don't think that's as beneficial as somebody just allowing you the space and maybe some tools to interpret it yourself. I'd say check us out. And if I can answer any questions, obviously I'm long-winded on this topic. I love talking about it. Ask me some questions. And I'd say I'll be speaking at the Psychedelic Science Conference in April in Phoenix. If you're in that neck of the woods, come out. I know Hamilton Morris will be there. Aubrey Marcus and some of these other names folks are familiar with, but I'll be there speaking. And I'd love to talk to anybody that has any interest in this work.
Awesome, Kirby. It's been great speaking with you today. Just to remind the listeners, you can find Kirby and on social media through Wounded Healer Outreach and also The Unchurch. And for the websites, we've got woundedhealeroutreach.com, all one word, and theunchurchchurch.com for The Unchurch, of course. So thank you so much for your time today and sharing your experience and your wisdom. Really appreciate it, Kirby, and appreciate the relationship that you have helped cultivate over the past year or more now between the two of us. And I enjoy the interchanges of information and perspective and viewpoint. Really valuable, and it's been great having you on the podcast.
I appreciate you, sir.